So I want you to imagine you are, I don't know, cleaning out your attic,
Oh,
right?
yeah, just a typical weekend project.
Exactly, just moving boxes. And you find this dusty, forgotten box of old Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 games,
Total artifacts at this point.
complete relics, but then you discover that they are suddenly worth like nearly $500 million overnight.
Which, I mean, that sounds like a bizarre accounting error, honestly.
Right. It sounds completely impossible, but in the weird world of interactive entertainment, that is precisely what happened last August. Two ancient Call of Duty games were just, well, quietly dropped onto modern consoles.
With absolutely zero marketing, too.
None. And within a single month, they generated $435 million.
Yeah, in almost any other industry, a product that old, just sitting dormant and then suddenly turning into a money printer, it would be
It
impossible.
makes no sense.
It really doesn't. But today's deep dive is exploring a massive, completely unexpected disruption that hit the gaming sector in August of 2026. We are analyzing this incredible telemetry data provided by the industry firm Alinea Analytics.
And we also have that really in-depth teardown by the publication Taken Game, right?
Exactly. And our mission here is to unpack how this untouched artifact from gaming's past just totally rewrote the economic rules for the future of the modern console industry.
Yeah, so to set the stage for you, here is what actually went down. Two classic decade-plus-old video games, Call of Duty Black Ops 1 and Black Ops 2, were unceremoniously shadow-dropped onto the PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5 digital storefronts.
And for anyone unfamiliar, a shadow drop just means there was absolutely no advance warning.
Right, there was no multi-million dollar marketing
No
campaign.
flashy Super Bowl trailers.
No pre-order bonuses, nothing. Just boom, it's a Randall Tuesday. And they are suddenly available to buy. And the financial fallout from that quiet release is just staggering.
Which is really why this is such a crucial topic for us to analyze today.
Yeah.
This goes far beyond, just a simple story about video games or feeling nostalgic.
Oh, definitely.
It's a masterclass in modern digital economics. I mean, we are looking at high-level corporate strategy between rival trillion-dollar companies.
And quite literally, the quantifying exact price of nostalgia in a digital marketplace.
Precisely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the hard telemetry data on what actually happened during that August 28-day window is, frankly, difficult to wrap your head around.
It really is wild.
We are talking about 11.2 million combined digital units sold. And that wasn't over a year or even a holiday quarter, that was in less than a month.
Under 4 weeks, yeah.
These two ancient games generated $435 million in gross consumer spending. $435 million for games that originally came out when, honestly, some of the people playing them today were still in elementary school.
Yeah, the sheer velocity of those sales is phenomenal. Especially when you look at the breakdown provided by Reese Elliott, the lead analyst at Alinea.
What did he find?
Well, Black Ops 2, which originally launched way back in 2012, really led the charge here. It accounted for 8.2 million of those units. Yeah, bringing in $325 million in revenue all on its own. And a really fascinating detail in that telemetry, 93% of those Black Ops 2 sales happened on the PlayStation 5.
Wait, on the PS5.
On the current generation hardware, yeah.
That volume on brand new hardware is just wild. Especially considering Black Ops 1 from way back in 2010 still managed to move, what, 3.0 million
Yep,
units?
for another $110 million.
That is insane. But what really caught my eye in the Tekken game teardown is that it didn't even stop at the base games.
Oh, the DLC.
Yes, the legacy DLC, the downloadable content map bundles that players used to buy over a decade ago, they sold 2.1 million individual packs.
Which is just, I mean, it's free money at that point.
Literally, that added an entirely separate $63 million to the revenue pile. We are talking about tens of millions of dollars for digital maps that were designed during the Obama administration.
It's crazy. The enduring value of those specific digital environments is remarkable. But, the real catalyst for this explosive purchasing behavior, it really lies in the pricing strategy.
Right, because they didn't charge full price.
Exactly. Activision set a $40 standard retail price for the base games, which is already, significantly cheaper than the $70 standard that brand new releases demand today.
Yeah, 70 is steep.
But the masterstroke was offering a promotional price of just $20 specifically for PlayStation Plus subscribers.
Oh, which creates the absolute ultimate frictionless impulse buy. I mean, you are sitting on your couch on a Friday night, you're scrolling through the digital storefront,
Yeah,
right?
looking for something to play.
And you see the exact game you and your friends obsessed over in high school. And it's only $20.
It's a no-brainer.
You don't have to drive to a store. You don't have to swap out a physical disc. You just hit a single button and it starts downloading.
It completely removes the barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm.
It lowers the financial risk for the consumer to a point where, honestly, nostalgia easily overrides any hesitation.
I get the nostalgia factor. I really do. But mechanically, how does this even work?
What do you mean?
Because gamers today, they expect the world, right? They want cutting-edge visuals. They want ray tracing, which, you know, for anyone unfamiliar, is that incredibly complex technology that simulates real-world light and reflections in real time.
Right. Highly demanding on the hardware.
Exactly. And they want massive physics engines. So you can't just drag and drop raw code from a 2010 PlayStation 3 onto a modern PS5 and expect it to run, can you?
Usually, no.
Wouldn't a game that old look terrible on a modern 4K television or just be completely broken?
What's fascinating here is how the engineering team, Iron Galaxy, navigated that exact problem. They used a process the industry refers to as catalog mining, specifically by executing what's called a straight port.
A straight port, meaning they didn't rebuild the game from scratch?
Correct. They didn't do a full remake at all. There are absolutely zero rebuild visual assets here.
Wait, really?
Yeah. No new textures, no new character models, nothing. They took the foundational software code from 2010 and 2012, and they basically wrapped it in a translation layer so the modern PlayStation 5 architecture could understand it.
Oh, that's clever.
It is. And to address your point about it looking terrible on a 4K television, they locked the resolution at native 1080p and forced it to run at a buttery smooth 60 frames per second.
Okay, so it's stable?
Very stable. It doesn't have modern ray tracing, obviously, but because the frame rate is perfectly consistent, it feels incredibly responsive.
But what about the online multiplayer? Because if you are just using code from 2010, how are millions of people playing together right now without the servers just, you know, catching fire?
Well, that is where modern infrastructure comes in. Back in 2010, multiplayer largely relied on peer-to-peer connections.
Oh, right. Where one player's console acted as the host for the whole lobby.
Exactly, which often cause terrible lag if their connection jerked.
It was the worst.
Yeah. But today, Iron Galaxy leveraged modern, highly scalable cloud networking. And these cloud instances, they cost pennies on the dollar compared to maintaining physical server blades a decade ago.
So it's way cheaper for them.
Vastly cheaper. So the game plays exactly how you remember it, but the invisible backend making all those connections happen is vastly superior and incredibly cheap to operate.
Which I guess also explains the file size. Because it's old code, right?
Right.
Without all those massive, uncompressed 4K audio files or insanely dense photorealistic textures, the storage footprint is tiny.
It really is.
I saw Black Ops 1 is only 18 gigabytes, and Black Ops 2 is 22 gigabytes.
Which is a massive selling point today.
Oh, huge. When modern games are bloated to like 150 gigabytes, basically forcing you to delete half your hard drive just to install a single new shooter.
Right. The operational efficiency of those small file sizes is a huge consumer benefit. But the real magic of the straight port is the corporate return on investment.
Okay, lay it on me.
Let's compare this strategy to the modern industry standard. If a publisher decides to do a full engine remake of a classic game, meaning they throw out the old code, they rebuild every single graphic, re-record the audio, modernize the mechanics.
Like a from the ground up situation.
Exactly. That process costs anywhere from $150 million to $250 million to produce today.
Just to remake an old game.
Yes. And it carries a massive amount of financial and marketing risk. I mean, if a $200 million remake flops, the entire studio might be shut down.
Wait, okay. So instead of risking $250 million, what did these straight ports actually cost them to make?
According to the data in the Taken Game Teardown, both ports combined cost under $5 million to produce.
Under $5
million? Yep.
So for the budget of an indie game, they are pulling in Avengers-level box office returns. The math on that is staggering. A $5 million investment generating $435 million in a month.
Yeah, it yielded a net return of over positive 8,000%.
That is absurd.
To borrow a metaphor, it's akin to a record label repressing a vintage vinyl album.
Oh, I like that.
Right. They don't need to rehire the band or rent a recording studio or pay for new production. They just dust off the master tape, press the vinyl, and collect pure profit. As the senior interactive entertainment analyst noted in that Tekken report, straight digital catalog mining carries vastly lower risk and exceptionally higher profit margins than $200 million full-scale remakes.
I love that vinyl analogy, though, because it gets to the heart of the deeply human element driving this. People aren't buying these games despite the old clunky mechanics, right? They are buying them because of those mechanics.
Exactly. It's a feature, not a bug.
Think about your own gaming fatigue today if you play games. Almost every major release is what the industry calls a live service, meaning it's not just a game, it's designed to be a second job.
It really feels like chores sometimes.
It does. You log in and you're immediately hit with battle passes, which are essentially these endless paid progression trees. You have daily chores you have to complete just to unlock a cosmetic shirt for your character.
The cognitive load of simply starting a modern multiplayer session has become quite high.
And then, when you finally get into a match, you are dealing with algorithmic skill-based matchmaking.
Right. SBMM.
Yes, SBMM, which is this invisible background system that constantly analyzes your skill level to ensure you only ever play against people exactly as good as you.
Which sounds fair in theory.
Sure, in theory. But the result is that every single casual Tuesday night game feels like the grand finals of a high-stakes esports tournament.
Right, you can never just relax.
It is exhausting. Players were desperate for the authentic, original gunplay. They wanted the classic skill match-free lobbies where you just jump in, you play with a random assortment of people, and you just have fun.
Yeah, much more relaxed environment.
And they wanted the unadulterated original zombies mode without 50 layers of modern progression. They just wanted to sit in a virtual room and defend a window from zombies with their friends, exactly like they did 14 years ago.
It really serves as the ultimate comfort food for an exhausted audience. This entire phenomenon provides empirical proof that player attachment to a perceived golden era of gaming is still one of the strongest market forces available.
Well, when you have a profit margin of over 8,000%, you don't just please your accountants, right? You actually start rewriting industry allegiances.
Oh, absolutely.
Because Microsoft is the company that owns this game now, but PlayStation players are the ones buying it in droves.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this launch fundamentally alters the corporate battlefield between Microsoft and Sony.
Tell me about it.
For anyone who hasn't tracked the broader corporate maneuvering, Microsoft recently spent nearly $70 billion acquiring Activision, the parent company of Call of Duty.
$70 billion. With a B.
With a B, yeah. And during that acquisition, there was a massive industry-wide fear. I mean, this even triggered federal trade hearings, that Microsoft was going to lock the franchise down entirely.
Right. The prevailing hypothesis was that Microsoft would make Call of Duty an exclusive title for the Xbox ecosystem just to deliberately crush PlayStation's market share.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, makes sense on paper. You buy the biggest game in the world, you force everyone to buy your plastic box to play it.
It makes sense conceptually, sure. But the $435 million generated by Black Ops 1 and 2 on PlayStation completely shatters that exclusivity myth.
Oh, totally.
It provides definitive, undeniable market proof of Microsoft's fiduciary strategy. Multi-platform revenue generation on PlayStation is simply too massive to ignore.
You can't just walk away from that money.
No, you can't. Microsoft has a legal and ethical obligation to its shareholders to recoup that $70 billion investment. You do not leave hundreds of millions of dollars on the table simply for console war bragging rights.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let's look at the mechanics of Sony's side of the equation.
Okay.
Sony made $130 million in pure, unadulterated profit from this shadow drop. And how did they earn it? Literally by doing nothing.
Just for existing.
Just for existing. Because they own the digital PlayStation store, they take a mandatory 30% platform fee on all digital sales, which, to be fair, is standard across most digital storefronts today.
Yes, very standard.
But they collected $130 million without spending a single dime on development, engineering, or marketing overhead.
The profit margins on platform fees are extraordinary.
Think of it like this. It's like Microsoft spends months baking this massive, incredibly lucrative, multi-tiered wedding cake, right?
Okay, I'm following.
They carry it all the way over to Sony's bakery to sell it to Sony's customers, and Sony just slices off a third of the cake and eats it simply for providing the counter space.
That is a great analogy. Mm-hmm. It is a brilliant arrangement for Sony, and it highlights exactly why they are perfectly happy to host software owned by their fiercest competitor.
Right.
Their digital store is essentially functioning as an automated toll booth.
A very lucrative toll booth.
Extremely. But we also have to examine Microsoft's benefit here to fully grasp why they are willing to share that cake, as you put it.
Okay, what do they get out of it besides the remaining cake?
Well, Microsoft walked away with a $304.6 million net payout after Sony took their cut.
Still a huge chunk of change.
Exactly. That influx of liquid cash is so substantial that it is single-handedly funding a massive slice of the quarterly operational costs for Microsoft's own first-party Xbox Studios.
Wait, so millions of PlayStation players buying a retro game on a Sony console are indirectly paying the salaries of the Xbox developers making the next Halo or Gears of War.
Precisely. It entirely validates Microsoft's strategic transition. They are no longer just a hardware manufacturer fighting a console war.
Right, they're bigger than that now.
Yes, they're positioning themselves as a massive multi-platform software publisher. Both of these bitter rivals are getting incredibly wealthy off of each other's ecosystems.
It establishes this fascinating frenemy dynamic.
That's a good word for it, yeah.
And it is actively reshaping competitive exclusivity expectations across the entire gaming industry.
Without a doubt.
So what does this all mean? If these two rivals are suddenly in a highly lucrative codependent relationship, what does this do to the industry roadmap? They figured out how to print money with decade-old code, so what happens next?
Well, the immediate future involves a very calculated promotional ramp. According to the strategic roadmap outlined in the Tekken Teardown, Activision is actively using these highly profitable legacy ports as a marketing vehicle for their current projects.
No synergy.
Exactly. Specifically, the brand new Modern Warfare 4 is scheduled for a fall October 2026 release.
Right.
With multiplayer beta testing kicking off in late August. Releasing these classic games right before the beta is a masterclass in brand re-engagement.
Oh, I see. It gets the entire global community playing, talking, and thinking about Call of Duty again.
Yes, and then they seamlessly transition that massive momentum directly into pre-orders for the new $70 title.
It's like serving everyone a phenomenally delicious, cheap appetizer to ensure they stick around and pay full price for the wildly expensive main course.
That's exactly it.
And it is obviously working, because the industry chatter generated by the single shadow drop is deafening. Every other publisher is staring at that 8,000% return on investment and scrambling to figure out how to emulate it.
Oh, they're all taking notes.
We are already seeing rumors swirling online that street ports for Black Ops 3 and the original Modern Warfare 2 are being fast-tracked into production as we speak.
And those future ports will almost certainly follow this exact template. The strategic impact of this data cannot be overstated.
Yeah.
It proves unequivocally to executives that core gameplay design and frictionless fun often drastically outweigh the appeal of expensive graphical polish.
Because fun is fun, right? No matter what it looks like.
Exactly. The industry is currently experiencing a historic reevaluation of its archival digital software.
Mm.
And for you, the consumer, there is a major silver lining to this corporate maneuvering.
Which is?
The overwhelming success of this legacy software guarantees that future blockbuster titles like the upcoming Modern Warfare 4 will be day one multi-platform releases. The era of the platform lock-in for major third-party franchises appears to be over.
Because everyone just wants their slice of that massive multi-platform pie.
Everyone wants the revenue.
It really is incredible to step back and look at the whole picture. Just to synthesize everything we've unpacked in this deep dive. An unannounced 14-year-old piece of software with absolutely zero marketing budget managed to completely rival the full-year sales of massive current-generation blockbuster titles.
Yeah, the sources point out this retro drop made as much money as Forza Horizon 6.
That is mind-blowing. It generated hundreds of millions of dollars for rival corporations overnight, and all it took was a tiny 20-gigabyte file, modern cloud servers, and a heavy dose of nostalgia.
It stands as an exceptional financial and strategic industry landmark. The data clearly shows that mining the past is currently the most lucrative strategy in the interactive entertainment sector.
Which, you know, leaves you with a pretty heavy question to ponder.
Yeah.
If an untouched decade-old game can provide an 8,000% return on investment simply by tapping into nostalgia, are we about to enter an era of gaming de-evolution?
That is a fascinating way to put it.
Right. I mean, if these trillion-dollar publishers realize that looking backward is vastly more profitable and infinitely less risky than innovating and inventing new mechanics, why would they ever take a creative risk again?
The financial incentive to innovate is certainly threatened.
Exactly. Are we looking at a future where original ideas are deemed too financially dangerous, trapping us in a highly monetized, endless subscription loop of our own childhoods?
It's a very real possibility.
It is something to seriously think about the next time you scroll through your digital storefront and feel the urge to buy the past. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
My pleasure.
It's been an absolute blast unpacking the weird, wild economics of our digital world with you. Stay curious. Keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you on the next one.